A boost in unemployment checks comes to an end, the school year approaches, and hurricane season is here. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Tens of thousands of South Floridians will experience a pay cut as the federal unemployment booster comes to an end. It added $600 a week to people who had lost jobs because of the pandemic. Congress and the White House are debating another stimulus round. As the end of the month approaches, how are you making your financial ends meet? 800-743-9576. Call now, 800-743-WLRN. Palm Beach County parents, students, and teachers already know the school year will begin online. This week, the school board pushed back the first day of school by 3 weeks. And already there are eight named storms this hurricane season. Your phone calls coming up on the South Florida Roundup, made possible by Willie the Bee Man, bee removal specialist. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week and supporting public radio. An extra unemployment payment from the federal government is due to expire next week. Out-of-work Americans have been receiving an extra $600 per week to help offset the economic downturn caused by the coronavirus pandemic. Tens of thousands of South Floridians could be affected if Congress does not agree on a plan soon to extend the stimulus. The end of the month is fast approaching. Rent is due. Deadlines for car and insurance payments, maybe student loans, mortgages, electric bills. How are you making ends meet at the end of another month during the pandemic? Share your experiences with us, won't you, here on the South Florida Roundup live on this Friday afternoon, 800-743-WLRN. Our voice line, 800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet, follow along, and communicate with us there. At WLRN is our handle. We're joined by Miami-Dade Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Mercosol Powell via FaceTime audio. She represents District 26, which includes communities in South Dade and Monroe County down to the southernmost point. Congresswoman, welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Nice to hear from you.
Hi, Tom. I hope you're doing well this afternoon.
And you and your family as well, who are
yes,
best.
Thank you.
So Senate Republicans have been negotiating with President Donald Trump around another stimulus, a COVID-19 economic stimulus. And the Senate Republicans are expected to release their plan now on Monday. What do you expect to be in it?
Yeah, great question, Tom. If you remember, we passed the HEROES Act over 2 months ago, which extends the $600 unemployment benefit that you just mentioned, and which is set to expire next week. Now, Republicans said that they wanted to hit a pause and negotiate a bill over the last 2 weeks while we saw COVID numbers surge in our communities in South Florida. And knowing that we just saw another 1 million, over 1 million people file for unemployment. So the Senate Republicans apparently right now are in disagreement about what to put in this bill. One of the main points of contention is this $600 amount that we included in HEROES Act. And what's interesting is just yesterday, last night, I held a teletown hall and we had over 5,000 of my constituents that were able to participate in this teletown hall. And overwhelmingly, most of my constituents say that they need, that they feel that the $600 unemployment benefit is the right amount. It was over 80% of my respondents said that. We were asking them to respond to those questions. They're using that money right now because they lost their job to pay their mortgage. They're using it to pay for, to put food on the table for their families. But Tom, let's remember, a lot of them lost their health care when they lost their jobs. Mm-hmm. So they need to use that money also for medicine, for health care, and for other needs that they have in their families.
The $600 federal booster is a flat rate for those that qualify for it, regardless of their previous income. It's set at $600. The Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, said on CNBC on Thursday that the federal unemployment booster would be, in his words, approximately 70% wage replacement. So thus, it would be floating based upon the person's lost income, not a flat rate. What would that mean in South Florida?
Well, you know, that's interesting because the reason why the House of Representatives chose that amount was we wanted to have a blanket amount that would cover people living all over the country. So instead of giving $200 to someone living in a rural part of the Midwest, we wanted to make it fair and even for all families across America.
Now, but $600 goes a lot further in the rural Midwest than it does in rural South Dade County.
Yes, but let's remember where we are. We are facing the most critical health and economic crisis this country has faced in generations. We are seeing more than 18 million people have now filed for unemployment. In the state of Florida, they can't even access the basic unemployment benefit of $275 a week.
Yeah, if the Senate and the White House, though, agree to a floating rate booster instead of a flat $600, is that something that you and your Democratic colleagues in the House could sign on to?
What we're saying is give us back what you agreed to. I mean, let's be honest. The Senate Republicans
meaning $600
an agreement, whether it's $600, whether it's a floating rate. You know, someone proposed $100, Tom, $100 a week. So we need to see what they come back with. And then I need to take a look at that and see if that's going to be appropriate for my community down in South Florida. And as you know, Miami has a very high cost of living, more than most cities across America.
Yeah, the average household income in Florida, which is a blunt mathematical statistic, about $56,000, that's $1,100 per week. 70% of that would be $750 if this 70% wage replacement that the Treasury Secretary floated mm-hmm. didn't have a cap on it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in my district, actually, the average income is about $44,000, so that would be also a little less. So how would they determine that, right? I mean, would they go by county? Would they go by... It seems like a complicated formula. And one of my concerns is that we can't even figure out a way to provide those $600 that we've already passed in the CARES Act back in March because the governor has yet to fix the unemployment system in our state. So,
right, because the state of Florida, the states are the ones that dole out the money that comes from the federal government in terms of that booster. And the state of Florida's unemployment system has been rife with delays and drop calls and dropped applications. What kind of confidence can you legislate from Congress regarding that kind of technological trip ups that has caught up so many Floridians?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've been doing here at the federal level is I spoke to the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee to help me because I had already sent a letter to the Department of Labor to help the state of Florida figure out the dysfunctionality of that system. We've been working closely with our local state senators who have also been putting pressure on the governor to fix that system. I know that the governor in Rhode Island had similar issues initially, but she contracted out a private IT company that was able to fix that system, and they've been processing thousands of applications, unemployment applications every day. We can do this. I know we can. It's about making sure
with
that
federal funds to the state?
No, I'm saying, yeah. So
in order to federal funds to the state to fix the state's unemployment system.
Yes. Well, actually, in the CARES Act, Tom, we appropriated additional funding to support the infrastructure because we knew that we're going to see a huge influx of applications coming in. So the state already has those funds. They can use those funds to fix the system. It's been months, and we still have a lot of people that have yet to see those unemployment benefits.
Congresswoman, stick with us here. Congresswoman yes. Debbie Mercosal-Powell is with us for the next several minutes, 800-743-9576. We're talking about federal government efforts for another coronavirus economic stimulus plan. The House approved a Democratic written plan a couple of weeks ago called the HEROES Act. Senate Republicans are due to release their stimulus strategy on Monday of next week. The $600 federal booster for unemployment benefits is due to expire at the end of this month as another month rolls over. And that, of course, brings another amount of due bills. I want to take your phone calls, 800-743-9576 here on the South Florida Roundup. How are you making ends meet as another end of the month approaches? 800-743-9576. Kamani Fisher Winter is with us, lives in North Lauderdale. Welcome to the Florida Roundup, Kamani. You've been able to keep your job during the pandemic. You're still employed, is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
Tell us about the end of the month as it's approaching and your financial situation as much as you'd like to share with us.
Well, we're basically just trying to make sure that our bills are somewhat paid, if at all possible. You know, my husband and I, we each have vehicles. We have a mortgage. We have the standard utility bills. We have children. So it's been a process, but, you know, we've been kind of almost making it. So we're just hoping that we can still pull through with all that's going on.
Has your income been affected at all by the pandemic and some of the public health measures that have been put in place to slow the spread of the disease?
Yes, I did actually volunteer for what they call voluntary time off. It basically gives me certain days off of work, and then I take a pay cut as a part of the agreement just to try and offset the cost of staying employed, to try and stay employed. I was able to volunteer and do that.
Yeah. So you have seen your income then pinched a little bit here.
Definitely, yes.
Yeah. How about your bills? Have they gone down by the same amount?
Oh, no, they have not changed at all. They still do.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you there. The bills tend to go in only one direction, unfortunately.
Absolutely.
And so how are you talking about, thinking about, discussing some of these stimulus measures that the Congresswoman is debating on Capitol Hill and the effect in your household? For instance, a stimulus check that perhaps you received a few months ago and the possibility of another round of stimulus checks coming.
Well, the stimulus check was definitely very helpful. It was something that allowed us to at least put a dent in the bills that had been mounting with COVID going on, because my husband did lose his job in March. So, you know, the stimulus check was extremely helpful during that time, and we're definitely advocates for another, since we're all trying to stay afloat right now.
I'm sorry to hear about your husband losing his job. Was that related to the pandemic?
Yes. So there's a lot of downsizing going on, I guess, when the company started forecasting the outcome of the pandemic. So, yeah.
Congresswoman Mercosul Powell, I know that Kamani is not one of your constituents in the 26th district, but what could you tell her about the conversations you're having in the House and with your Senate colleagues regarding the possibility of another stimulus payment?
Yeah. And Kamani, thank you so much for sharing your story. Let me just say that she is actually one of thousands of people. It's the same story that I hear also locally in my area. And the work that we're doing is to support all of you, whether you're our constituents or not. And we did include in the HEROES Act initially, we passed this bill back in May, and it puts money in your pocket, Camille. So we included that direct payment, a second round of direct payments for families. So it could be up to $6,000.
Was it the same $1,200?
Yes, and it could be up to $6,000 per household. So $1,200 for Kimani, $1,200 for her husband, and then depending on if they have children, they could receive an additional payment as well. So that is included in HEROES, which is why we have been intent on making sure that the Senate passes the bill that we passed to them 2 months ago. They've had 2 months to negotiate, Tom, and they're right now scrambling, trying to figure out what they're going to present to us.
Kamani, you've got a chance to talk to an elected official right now with the vote on Capitol Hill regarding possibly the fate of that stimulus check and to others. What would you like Congress to know about what's happening in your bank account with your bills?
Well, I would definitely want them to know that we pay our taxes on time as best possible every year. We work very hard, so it would behoove the country to make sure that the people who are paying these taxes are taken care of in times of crisis, because that's, as far as I know, that's the whole purpose of paying taxes in the first place. So I really appreciate Ms. Mercosul Powell for looking out for us and advocating for us, because we can't all stand in front of a podium and talk to people and advocate for ourselves. So her voice is exceptionally needed right now.
Kamani, we appreciate you sharing your story. Thanks for joining us on the roundup here. Best of luck to you and your family.
Thank you.
Kamani Fisher-Winter with us lives in North Lauderdale. You can share your experiences at the end of another month here during the pandemic. How are you making ends meet? 800-743-9576. Congresswoman Debbie Mercosul Powell continues with us. Congresswoman, we're going to talk to, looks like, Fred in Miami on line 5. Go ahead, Fred. You're on the radio.
Hello, Congresswoman, I was wondering if I can get a number to call for the stimulus check. I never received the first one.
Yeah, Fred, and my office is always available to help you or anyone that needs assistance. So I'm going to give you the number now. It's 305-222-0160. My team has a very good relationship with all the federal agencies, including the IRS, and we have gotten those calls as well, and we've been able to help. So please go ahead and call my office, and we'll see what happened there and why you didn't receive that check.
All right, and that will be 222-0160.
That's correct.
Fred, we appreciate it. Best of luck. Thanks for calling in and listening to WLRN. Congresswoman, we've got Scott in West Palm Beach on line two. Scott, thanks for holding on. You're part of the conversation now. Go ahead.
All right. Thank you very much. Well, I'm a gig worker. And when I heard you all say about trying to factor in an average salary, I don't have an average salary.
Yeah.
I can have a good month and then not work for 2 months. And I'll be honest with you, the $600 has been a lifesaver for us. It's enabled us to eat. It's enabled us to pay our electric bill, stay current with our home. And I think what really kind of chaps me is the money goes back into the system. It's not like I'm investing in stocks or anything. I'm surviving with it. And when I read this morning about them saying, well, maybe $100 a week, I kind of laughed. I'm going, that's, you know, $100 to me, something's better than nothing. But that's a slap in the face. And Mnuchin's worth $300 million. I don't think he's really sweating if he's going to have a roof over his head.
You're referring to the Treasury Secretary. Scott,
yeah,
let me ask you, as a gig worker, a freelance worker, so you don't have a steady paycheck, you're not a W-2 employee for another
correct
company, you're a 1099 tax situation. Have you been working? Have you been collecting pay checks?
I have gotten a little bit of work, but I would say since March I've worked maybe 11 days. I'm a freelance cinematographer, videographer, and that business shut down. It's
mm-hmm.
just now coming back very smallly, in a very small way, and it kind of cut the legs right off of that.
Yeah. Scott, I appreciate you sharing your story, and thanks for calling in there from West Palm Beach.
Congressman
Mercosol Powell, this gig worker,
yes.
Certainly in South Florida, the gray economy, the cash economy when it comes
yeah.
to labor, for instance, it's a significant part of the local and regional economy. How is that being considered as part of another stimulus package?
Yes. And Tom, absolutely. You know, when we were negotiating CARES, I actually had several calls with my local elected officials in the southern part of Miami-Dade and also in Monroe. And they were reminding me to make sure and include the gig worker economy in those unemployment benefits. And we did. So because the state of Florida doesn't recognize that economy
right.
for to pay, you know, the unemployment benefits.
For the
so
state
we
side
did
of
that.
Unemployment,
we,
right.
we did that. And what I've heard is that it's been very difficult for them to get those payments, but we're working through that. It's also included once again in the HEROES Act. Let's not forget, like Scott said, that they are a huge part of our economy and they contribute. Those $600 allow people to pay again for their rent. They allow them to purchase those basic necessities. And that's important also for economic recovery. What I'm worried about, and since I had a couple of minutes here, I worked out the 70% for a $44,000 annual salary in my district, and it would actually be $616 a week. That would be 70% of their income if we were to go by that model. So that just shows you that $600 a week of unemployment benefit is the bare minimum for people living in my district.
And I've seen research in Miami-Dade County from the FIU Metropolitan Center that the $600 a week annualized is what, $32,000 a year, which is a pay boost for a significant percentage of workers in South Florida that
correct.
That have taxable income.
Yeah,
and the criticism, right, is that higher federal unemployment boost is a disincentive for people to rejoin the labor market.
Yes, and that's exactly what I was going to say. You know, the conversation shouldn't be whether $600 a week is too much. the conversation is, why are we not raising wages for our workers in an area where the cost of living continues to increase? We have had an affordable housing crisis in South Florida for a few years. Lack of access to quality health care. I mean, those are the issues that we need to be addressing.
Congresswoman, I want to squeeze in as many calls as we can here we still have time. Alexis in Coral Gables wants to ask about an industry that is dominant and an industry that arguably kind of holds down some of those wages. Go ahead, Alexis.
Hi, Congresswoman. This is Alexis on Coral Gables. And seeing how the first quarter of this year is a massive, income level for entertainment and hospitality with Winter Music Conference, and now it's looking like Art Basel, which is another huge income for a lot of these workers, doesn't seem possible. And because we're in the phase four, you know, our income and our profit basically is made with large groups of people, and it seems like a whole nother year maybe until we get back into things. So seeing how that's a majority of our economy and our GDP here in South Florida, I just don't think, you know, this it's not fair for the mismanagement of government that we may have to now change careers. So I think there needs to be a talk about how we're specifically going to target those industries, restaurants, hotels, nightclubs, bars, festivals, event producers.
Tourism overall. Alexis, thanks for that question. Congresswoman Mercosal-Powell, how about any special carve-outs for hospitality?
Yes, absolutely. Actually, I'm one of the main co-sponsors for a bill that would provide significant funding and support to our restaurant industry. And also,
what's the form of that funding?
So it would provide relief to restaurants, to hotels, to the service industry that would be impacted, that could show that they've been significantly impacted by loss of revenue because of COVID.
But relief how, though?
And well, they would apply for federal funding. They would have to apply for a fund.
So a loan or a grant?
It's a grant. And it's more geared towards independent and small restaurant owners and hospitality owners. But we did also advocate for help with the entertainment industry. And I signed a letter with Representative Adam Schiff. We're working through that. We did include support to the arts in the CARES Act. And I believe I need to double check, but I think it's included in HEROES Act, support for local and small municipalities, state governments, also 501c3s and 501c4s are included in HEROES Act. So the CARES Act was one of the first bills that we passed just to address the impact that we were seeing that was coming from the pandemic. And then we addressed other issues that we left out in CARES through HEROES.
And I think HEROES comes in at $3 trillion. Is that about
at
right?
At this point, yes. Yeah. Yes. At this
one more call here with the Congresswoman Bud in Boynton Beach. Go ahead, Bud. You're on the radio.
Yeah, I just want to let you know that your people are listening that unemployment ends Saturday here, I believe it is, or Sunday, not the end of the month, because that's not a full week. So don't count on getting that check. Second, can you imagine they can't even get a simple checkout? Could you imagine if they had to figure out how much everybody made and give them 60% of what they made? You wouldn't see a check for the rest of your life.
But I appreciate it. In fact, that is a criticism of this idea of having a floating federal unemployment booster, because the technology just isn't there to be able to make those kinds of calculations. And to Bud's point about next week not being a full week, very important point there, Bud. Mm-hmm. And to Congresswoman Mercosal-Powell, are you going to have legislation, do you think, by the end of next week?
Well, I think that the pressure is on, right? I think that the Senate is feeling that pressure, and they will be discussing that. There are a lot of different people, including our own senators, by the way, that believe that $600 is just too much money. And that I think that's where they're having those issues in the Senate. Now, I think Bud is right that if we start putting certain requirements on this unemployment, it just sounds to me like another system that's set up to fail. And what type of documentation are they going to require, especially for our gig workers? Are they going to ask now for pay stubs? What if you're a waitress? How do you prove the income that way? Right. So, again, that's why we made it a blanket $600 a week for all Americans that have lost their jobs due to COVID.
Congresswoman Debbie Mercosol-Powell represents the 26th Congressional District, the southernmost in the United States. Congresswoman, thanks for your time today to join us on the South Florida Roundup.
Thank you so much, Tom. Stay safe.
You as well. We did extend an invitation to both senators of Florida, Senator Rick Scott and Senator Marco Rubio. They did not take us up on our invitation. Still to come, South Florida districts are considering starting school later and fully online. We'll talk about the state of public education in the pandemic next on the South Florida Roundup. Back on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Governor Ron DeSantis made it clear this week parents should decide whether to send their kids back to school next month.
No parent should be required to send their child to in-person instruction if they don't want to. I also believe that special accommodations must be made for all students with significant health issues who may be more at risk from the virus.
The governor gave a short address in Tallahassee as the debate over schools reopening continues throughout the state, including here in South Florida, and for that matter, across the country. Now, in our region, we're facing a coronavirus surge, worrying school leaders about the possibility of having teachers, staff, and students safely back in classrooms. The Palm Beach County School Board voted to delay the start of the school year this week, moving it back to August 31st. Miami-Dade is considering taking a similar step. So join our conversation. What are your concerns, questions about the start of another school year online in a building? Delayed. What about athletics being delayed? 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. The education reporter for our news partner, the Miami Herald, Colleen Wright, joins us now. So, Colleen, what's the state of the starting date for Miami-Dade County? Let's begin there.
Sure. So the starting date is still August 24th. The idea was kicked around at the latest school board meeting to possibly push it back, but Miami-Dade County Public Schools actually had the advantage of already having a later start date. So for now it stays, but it's still in the conversation.
And how does that first day of school look for Miami-Dade?
Really good question. Miami-Dade County, as you know, is still in phase one. You know, we're still seeing surges of coronavirus cases. The plan that Miami-Dade County School Board approved kind of looks at it from different ways. They, you know, everyone hopes for in-person instruction. That is the best way to teach a child. But it's just at this point, it's not safe to open school. So right now it's looking very likely that we will start the school year online. The United Teachers of Dade, the teachers union here in Miami-Dade County, has already told its members, just go ahead and prepare for virtual. To teach virtually, because, you know, teachers have to get their lesson plans in order. So they've already called it. But right now it's actually too soon to really call it for sure. But I think it's everyone's best guess that we would start online.
It's not definitive just yet for Miami-Dade County, but Palm Beach County, it is definite that it is all online and it's going to be later than originally planned. Palm Beach County schools were supposed to open up on August 10th, but the school board this week delayed that. Andrew Mara joins us now, covers education for the Palm Beach Post, joins us via FaceTime audio. Andrew, tell us about this decision. Another long meeting prior to this vote, correct?
That's right. And the school board had been signaling for a couple of weeks that they really felt most comfortable delaying the start of the school year, but in the last few weeks, it really took on a life of its own. And you're seeing this happen across the state, of course, where everyone thinks the best bet at this point is to push things back to give people more time to adjust, and also in the hopes that pushing back the start of school will mean fewer weeks teaching online.
And the pushback of the start of school for Palm Beach County, is that primarily to give teachers and staff the opportunity to get all of their technology ducks in a row, or is it a matter of looking at the infection rates and the hospitalizations, and should those be trending down, perhaps turn on a dime and welcome students and teacher staff back to the classrooms on August 31st?
It's really a little bit of both. The school board member who proposed doing this 2 weeks ago said her primary goal in doing it was to hopefully reduce the amount of time that students are actually stuck, so to speak, taking classes online from home. Her thinking was, well, if we push it back, then at some point the schools will hopefully reopen, and this will mean more days on campus in classrooms and fewer days of the school year spent online. But the district has also said this is really key for them. They think this is all useful for helping to get teachers prepared for what will be a school year like no other. And it's going to involve a lot of heavy lifting. So they think the extra time is beneficial there too.
Andrew Morrow with the Palm Beach Post-Stick with us. Colleen Wright with the Miami Herald is with us, two education reporters. Dan in Miami is joining our conversation. Go ahead, Dan. You're on the radio.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. As far as education is going here in Miami-Dade, now I understand that teachers you often do what is called small group instruction and group rotation. I don't see how bringing children back into the classroom at the date proposed by the Commissioner of Education would help in that, because then the teachers would have to move up close to the students, and that's not a good thing considering what the virus that's going around. Teachers, I would imagine, would have to resort to lecturing, which is considered ineffective. So I have my doubts as to the efficacy of the governor's plans as far as education is concerned. I would say to the parents of the children, do not sacrifice your children to the whims of DeSantis. And to teachers and staff, I would definitely say, do not die for DeSantis.
Dan, we appreciate the perspective. Thanks for joining us here. Colleen, to Dan's first point about the mechanics of teaching, so much of the plans and contingency plans have to be very detailed around physical space, how teachers are interacting, how students are getting on and off buses, how you're dealing potentially with the return to students to cafeterias, to gymnasiums. That planning still continues, doesn't it? Even if the call is made in Dade County ultimately to go online, as the call has already been made in Palm Beach County?
It does, yes. And, you know, the caller's, what he's talking about is kind of 10 steps ahead of where we even are right now. And yes, there are a lot of details out there. If it is safe for schools to resume in the schoolhouse, they would have to, there's mandatory masks, required social distancing. They would have to space classes out into the gym, into the cafeteria, or media center or library. Even on buses, they would have to be spaced out. But even still, you know, those are details right there, but there's even more details of like, okay, how does that even happen?
Yeah.
Those details even haven't even still been come to light, or at least haven't been made public yet. Like for example, I'll give you an example here. I asked what happens when a student or a teacher or any kind of school employee tests positive for coronavirus. Those plans have not really been made public yet, but in an interview with Superintendent Alberto Carvalho last week, he told me that there's kind of like this decision tree that either one classroom could be isolated or two or three, or the school could be partially shut down or totally shut down. So there's so many scenarios up in the air, and we just really don't know. And I know it seems like a lot of people that I've spoken to do have faith in the school district to do the right thing, but we just really don't even know if we'll even be back in the schoolhouse by August 24th.
We have focused our conversation on public schools, certainly. Private schools also, and parochial schools also a question. Lourdes in Kendall joining our conversation. Lourdes, thanks for calling in. Your thoughts?
Yes, I work at a private school, and we're very fortunate enough to have funding to be able to do the spacing, bring kids on alternate days, to have masks and shields for the teachers and things of that nature. But I'm still curious as to, you know, in regard to what happens with private schools. If the public schools don't open, are we required to open because we have these? Can we do something different? Should we shut down if public schools are shutting down? And then there's the question of what happens to the parents of teachers who are in a private school who are required to go in, but then have kids in a public school who don't. So what happens to them?
Yeah, very difficult. The questions of should are going to be judgment calls, but the questions of responsibility. Andrew Morrow, what about in Palm Beach County? The school board obviously doesn't have any jurisdiction over private schools, but generally, what are you hearing?
Well, many private schools are planning to do at least partial reopenings. The Catholic schools plan to be doing it. I don't know all the details of how the reopenings are going to go, but they do plan at least some partial resumption of classes in the classroom. but they, I believe, have also pushed back their start dates here locally, if I'm not mistaken.
Colleen, can you share in your reporting that you've got around private schools?
Sure, absolutely. The Archdiocese of Miami, which includes like 65 schools in Monroe, Dade, and Broward counties, is kind of in the same boat as the Miami-Dade School District. In fact, a headline from Wednesday on the Archdiocese website says classes to resume August 19th, but that's the only thing certain as Catholic schools weigh online and in-person options.
Yeah.
Obviously, private schools can do whatever they want. You know, they're obviously self-sovereign. But a lot of them do look to public schools, school districts as to what to do. A lot of
as the leadership component there. Colleen, we got to leave the conversation there, but thanks for sharing your reporting with us as always.
All right, thank you.
Colleen Wright, education reporter at the Miami Herald. Andrew Mara, thanks for sharing your reporting as well, reporter at the Palm Beach Post. Still to come, it is hurricane season. We're back on the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. There's already an eighth named storm, and it's only July. This is the earliest on record. There has been an H storm. And there's another wave, tropical wave, just rolling off West Africa this weekend. Another storm we're watching is Tropical Storm Gonzalo. It's further out in the Atlantic now, and it's projected to go northwest toward the Gulf of Mexico. There's no immediate threat to Florida. Forecasters have warned that this hurricane season will be busy. This year, emergency management folks have been added to the complication of the coronavirus pandemic. I spoke with WLRN's environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich to get the latest about the tropics and preparations for when a storm threatens South Florida. Jenny, welcome back to the South Florida Roundup. You know, when Gonzalo became a named tropical storm this week on Wednesday, the National Hurricane Center included a line in its discussion. I'm sure you saw it. I saw it. It said that Gonzalo is the earliest seventh named storm on record in the Atlantic Basin, beating Gert of 2005. By 2 days. Simple sentence, but boy, there's a lot of history packed into those words, isn't there?
Especially 2005.
Yeah, that was Katrina, of course, devastating for New Orleans, but also Hurricane Wilma here in South Florida.
Right. Those back-to-back hurricanes came across South Florida, and I think anybody who lived down here will definitely remember 2005. And not just, I mean, Katrina, obviously, but just to get those the two big storms like that in a single year hit here was remarkable.
And it really put the National Hurricane Center with that line this week with Gonzalo, to me, it really put that reminder yet again about how vulnerable we are and moving into the most riskiest time of this hurricane season. So what are meteorologists saying about the season here as we move into this real busy time?
At the beginning of the season, they said that we were going to have yet another above average season. This would be the fifth season in a row for us to have this season. I think we lucked out a little bit at the beginning when it's normally it is the slow part of the season, but we also had a lot of Saharan dust, which helped out. But now we are moving toward the peak of the season. The peak starts in mid-August. The actual peak hits September 10th, the anniversary of Irma. And so this is the time of year when we really need to keep an eye out on these storms. Gonzalo, as they pointed out in the advisories, is a small storm that makes forecasting harder. They fluctuate up and down when they're small. So yeah, this is the time of year when, as they say, everybody needs to make sure they have that plan in place for a storm.
Indeed. And we're going to talk about that planning in a moment, but let's talk about kind of just the meteorological conditions here that exist. Another anniversary of Irma coming up in September. That was an I storm. We're already on G, and it's not even August right now. So are we expecting the pace to pick up? Is that the anticipation as forecasters looked at this season just a few months ago?
They were sort of looking at whether or not we were going to get a La Nina, which would help tamp down storms. That didn't happen. We were in a neutral phase. And so that means that yeah, we can get busier as the season goes on. We also have really high sea surface temperatures. The tropical Atlantic, the Gulf of Mexico, If you look at the maps that show sea surface temperatures, you'll see them all lit up in orange and red. I mean, it's just the water's very warm.
Yeah, low 80s, mid 80s in terms of where even Gonzalo is coming through in the southern Caribbean Sea. Very hot for this time of year already.
Right, right. And that just fuels these storms even more.
How does the forecast compare to what we experienced last year or over the past couple of years? Dorian, of course, took that famous and thankful for South Florida right turn, devastating for the Bahamas. But of course, the Panhandle is only just a couple of years removed from Michael. And here we are, you know, coming up on the third anniversary of Hurricane Irma.
You know, every year is different, whether they make landfall. When they forecast the number, they always say, we're forecasting this many, but we can't tell you yet where they're going to make landfall. I think when storms get into the Gulf, obviously they make landfall somewhere. And what has happened with these really hot sea surface temperatures too, is that things can fuel up very, very quickly. And again, I bring up these small storms because those are the ones that can just explode very, very fast. The number of storms last year, we had about 20 depressions. We had six hurricanes and then three major, like Cat 3 storms, and a total of 18 tropical storms. So that's sort of on par for this year. But again, it's where they make landfall, right?
Yeah, indeed. And as you mentioned, the forecasting ability for path has improved tremendously over the past many years. But the intensity forecasting is still as much art as it is science. And we can read that in the advisories even for Gonzalo, with the forecasters acknowledging that the intensity forecast for this one storm has been very difficult, in part because of the size, but because these intensities that we've saw with Michael, with Dorian, have, you know, brought in more questions than the science and technology can answer right now.
Right. And they're sort of making progress, or we're getting a better understanding of intensity. Forecasting it is still very difficult. But for example, with Michael, they're looking at currents and how currents in the Gulf played a part in that. They know that there were some warm eddies moving along the coast. And as soon as the hurricane came across that, it just, you know, it took off. So they're factoring in sort of more conditions. I mean, they know what drives intensity. Now the question is, how can they forecast it?
Better measuring, better capturing the data, and then the better science that goes into the forecasting. You know, this latest tropical wave that we've experienced even this week, I mean, it's brought a lot of cloud cover and a lot of rain. How prepared are the canals and Lake Okeechobee for this busiest part of the rainy season coming up?
Well, this year they ran they kept the lake a little bit lower. They were trying to do this to avoid having to do the flushing to the coast that triggers algae blooms. When the water comes up, they have to move more, obviously. We got hit with some record rain in May that caused some significant flooding in Miami-Dade County, especially in my front yard. And so they operate these canals jointly with local authorities, because it's not just a drainage, but it's a water supply issue too. So there was some talk of keeping them lower. I think they're always having to sort of tweak the system, especially now when they're getting more rainfall. We know that these storms are producing more rain now. There's just more rain outside tropical systems. That's been documented. The last time I checked, you know, they're not having to do the big flushing to the coast because they haven't had as much rain over the lake. But that'll be something they keep an eye on.
You are listening to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, speaking with WLRN's environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich about hurricane season. Gonzalo in the Caribbean Basin and the Atlantic Ocean. A reminder that the busiest part of hurricane season, for South Florida at least, is still to come. Gonzalo is no immediate threat to Florida. Now, we do have a list of resources to help you prepare for hurricane season. You can find it on our homepage on the internet, WLRN.org. Look for the banner that says Hurricane Ready. Click on that, and you can take a look at some preparations. Jenny, of course, this hurricane season is special because it is happening amidst a pandemic, as public health officials and the community try to fight and slow the spread of COVID-19. And among those precautions are to stay away from crowded spaces. Well, as you know, right, when a hurricane threatens, folks need to crowd together in order to take shelter. So how are state and local officials preparing for the event of a hurricane and evacuations in South Florida in the age of COVID.
Right. So in Miami-Dade County, for example, they have always had 82 shelters available, but they didn't necessarily open them all. Now they're planning to have them all open because they know they need to make space for people within these shelters. And also, you know, in your supply kits, you're now going to have a mask and hand sanitizer, not just water and food. The state also has a plan. The details are still a little vague to provide hotel rooms to kind of take the pressure off counties when it comes to making space and shelters to accommodate everybody. One of the things that the emergency managers I talk to are concerned about is just people's, you know, the willingness to evacuate when they need to. I talked to somebody today who said, you know, sometimes people just get on a plane and leave. Well, now they may not want to get on a plane, or they may go stay with friends who are outside an evacuation zone. Now their friends may not want them.
Yeah. We spoke on this program with Frank Rollison, who is the head of Miami-Dade's emergency management, several months ago about just this issue. Here's what he said.
And the fear is that the people that are in these evacuation zones, if we get to the point we have to tell them to leave, that they're not going to leave.
So, Jenny, how are officials kind of managing these expectations? How are these concerns being addressed at the end of July as the busiest part of the season still approaches?
They always stress at this time of year to really have a plan, but now they're stressing more than ever that your plan needs to you know, don't put it off to the last minute, because there are limits to how much you can do in a short amount of time because of other emergency orders because of the coronavirus. They really want you to especially have an evacuation plan, not just have your water and your food and your flashlights and all your papers in order. But they want you to know where you live. If you're in a zone that's likely to get evacuated, those maps are available on county websites. Miami-Dade County has an app you should probably sign up for now that will let you check that map, check evacuation orders, check which shelters are open and which one you should go to. The information is out there. They want you to access it now and not wait till the last minute, because COVID-19 has just, you know, made planning so difficult now.
One of the changes or evolutions in messaging from Irma to Dorian was about how far away to evacuate, right? So, you know, evacuate miles away from home if possible, as opposed to time zones away from home, like a lot of folks did during Hurricane Irma and got caught on I-95 or the Turnpike or 75 or I-10 as almost the entire state of Florida came under the cone for Irma. And now here we are in a situation where officials are encouraging, look for those evacuation plans near your home if your home is in one of those evacuation zones.
Right. And I think that's why they want you to, like you said, and like I said, you know, look at the map that shows what zone you're in. So when a mayor issues an order that says, you know, zone A, zone B have to evacuate, well, you don't have to leave the county. You can go to zone D or or E. You know, you just have to move into the next zone. Again, the state plan to offer hotel rooms to people is a way to provide shelter closer to where you live, so you're not going to get stuck on the turnpike trying to either flee up the state and far away.
The state calls this hotel plan non-congregate sheltering. How is it supposed to work?
I mean, I've had trouble getting the details so far, but basically they are contacting hotels and having hotels sign up in advance to provide hotel rooms, and they will make those available via an app where you can register in advance, and then they will pay for food and shelter for 7 days. It's not yet clear where those hotels are or how many there will be.
Lots of questions. What about, like, pets? That's always a big question for people when they decide whether or not to evacuate.
Right. And some hotels will accommodate pets and some won't. I know the governor signed an order requiring all counties to have at least one shelter where you can bring your pets.
We've seen the construction of some of these field hospitals, one set up at the Miami Beach Convention Center. So that's inside an existing building. Do you know about any plans about protecting patients during a storm?
Well, when I talked to county officials, they said they raised the same concerns with the state, that Miami Beach did not seem like a great place to put a field hospital, even one that's housed within, you know, a building and not in a tent, because Miami Beach is one of the first places evacuated. It's evacuated, I believe, with a Cat 1 storm. So they would have to move those patients to other places.
After all, it's a barrier island. Jenny Stiletovich covers the environment and watches the radar, along with most of us this time of year, especially very closely. Jenny, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
This hurricane season is forecast to be busy. It already is. 8 named storms as of this Friday. You can get prepared now if you haven't already. WLRN has put together a guide to help you be storm ready. You can find it all on our homepage, WLRN.org, and then look for the banner that says Hurricane Ready. That'll do it for the Roundup here this week. The South Florida Roundup is produced by Alexander Gonzalez. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Lance Dixon is our digital editor. News director Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's director of radio programming is Jason Zabka. The director of radio operations and the program's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling, listening, and supporting public radio. This program is made possible by Willie the Bee Man, Bee Removal Specialist.